you shouldn't be scared. You will be a little...
I told you, you'll be disappointed in me. It's fine. Mm-hmm. I'm okay with that. Mm-hmm. I just...
Wow.
I'm having a hard time. Not really, no.
All right. Hi, everyone.
Hello.
Welcome to the Summit Bookish Podcast. Hey. Special, not really special edition, but it could be special edition because we're about to get started on a whole entire series at this point.
Yes. Do you want to announce the series first, or do we want to do that after we've been done
introductions? After we've done the introduction
okay.
stuff.
All right.
So, hi, everyone. Welcome to Semi-Bookish. We're going to get started right away.
With?
What we're reading.
So, what are you reading?
What I'm reading?
Yeah.
Well, besides, you know, this book.
Uh-huh.
I decided to take the plunge because, you know, TikTok is book talk and things.
I'm sorry. Go ahead. Carry on.
I know. Don't even
I don't know where you're going with this. That's why I'm like, what are we doing? What are we plunging into?
Everyone, so like, dark romance is like all over my TikTok for you page, right? And I'm like, okay, fine, whatever. I'll just read it because I want to see the hype. So I started. Oh god, I can't even believe I'm saying this out loud, but I am. It's Haunting Adeline.
Oh, okay. I actually have not heard of this.
It is so, it's one of those things that, like, if you're part of, like, book talk in general.
Sure.
Especially if you're in the romance side of it.
Sure.
Like, the dark romance side of it.
Sure.
This is, like, the book that gets recommended to you by people. Oh, like, you don't know anything until you've read this one. And I'm like.
Okay. By H.D. Carlton?
Yeah.
Okay.
Do we have a standard definition, Carlton? As well?
An SD Carlton? You know, I kind of want to know if we do.
He's like the normal Carlton. Just,
yeah.
To be honest,
yeah.
But
he needed an upgrade, so HD Carlton was born.
I'm only 13 pages in.
I don't know
at this
if she's
moment.
A she or not. I don't know.
It is a she. I am
so good. There's no SD Carlton, though. Anyway.
It is. I am.
Pen name for you there.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, Carlson.
I'm like 13 pages in, and let me just... okay, anyways.
Yeah?
So, how do I describe this as the nicest way possible?
I don't know if nice is going to be a good thing today, but go ahead, carry on. Yes, you were saying?
I want, especially in certain genres, especially in the TikTok recommended book era.
This isn't getting any better.
No, I know it's not. Stop recommending books that are horrible in first person and sound like they are a horribly written Wattpad fanfiction, please.
Okay, but you're getting recommendations from...
No, I just wanted to know what the hype was around this.
Well, what have you found, actually? So far,
this girl is a... So this is all in first person, by the way.
First of all, we
all know is one of my biggest icks in terms of, one, romance, but also, two, just, like, in general.
It's not your thing, in general.
Especially if it's written like this, because it sounds like how I would be describing something to you, because this girl is supposed to be, like, an author. She's taken her mom, her grandma's, dead grandma's estate. Mm-hmm.
Carry on. Yes.
And she's like, the first reader approaches me and my book, and then she tells me what the book name is in her hands with a beaming smile on her face. Oh my god, it's so awesome to meet you. She's like, oh yeah, Team Freckles, because we also both have freckles. Oh my god, I'm so awkward. Is like the thing she says right after this.
Is that an actual quote?
Well, I'm paraphrasing so I don't get copyright claimed.
I see.
For saying stuff out loud. But I'm just like...
Would that fall under free use? Like, in a podcast like this?
I don't know.
Interesting question to look into.
I don't want to find out.
Yeah, like, it's a whole minefield. I don't know.
It is a minefield. Yeah. I know this from being an art student. But it's written in, like, first person, which is like, okay, fine, I'll deal with it, whatever. But, like, it gives, like, I'm getting kidnapped by One Direction fan fiction in Wattpad 2012. Mm. And I just can't handle it.
Okay, I didn't know that I needed a new category of fan fiction. But if that's not one yet, I need that to be a category.
Getting kidnapped. It's very specific.
Getting kidnapped by One Direction. Yeah, that's fantastic.
No. It is a whole entire genre of fan fiction, especially, like... around 2012 era, and that's where you get After from.
Oh, I know that.
Yeah, well. You get it from the I Got Kidnapped by One Direction fan fiction.
Got era. It. Okay.
Like, it is a whole thing. So
you're not enjoying it.
13 pages in, and it has yet to redeem itself, but I want to get to a certain chapter that I know exists.
I love how it has yet to redeem itself haven't even...
is the sin that it's committed the fact that it exists?
No, the sin that it committed is the fact that it's written in first person, and it sounds like a 12-year-old girl writing on Wattpad in 2012.
Mm. The lack of redemptive... Yeah, okay, sure. That's a fair thing to be annoyed by.
It's giving, like, I could read this on fanfiction.net/archive of our own for free as a self-insert, and it would be a whole lot better if it was just a self-insert fanfiction at this point.
Oh!
Anyways, yeah. I'm still playing Fallout 4, though, because I'm still trying to finish it. Well, not finish it. I'm not going to finish it before then, because you can't exactly finish the game. But, because it's a never... It's like a Skyrim.
I know.
It's like a Skyrim. But because I'm trying to play the game before
the new one comes out, right?
The show. The TV show.
Oh.
They're doing a TV show on Prime for Fallout.
That's right. You did tell me that.
Yeah. I was supposed to like April 12th or something. Yeah. And so I'm playing all my Fallout games in preparation for lore that I already know about anyways, but sure. You know, I'm like, this is, so, because it's Bethesda, so it plays like Skyrim, I'm like level 38 or something, and I still haven't touched the main quest at all. I've just been running around.
That's the best way to play Skyrim, by the way.
For this game, it's not.
Oh.
In the fact that I'm trying to get, like, certain characters' affinities all the way up, because you get certain... So, unlike Skyrim, the cool part about Fallout is you have, like, a certain amount of companions, and if you get their affinity all the way up, you get a perk.
Oh, that's cool.
And that perk stays with you even if, like, you stop they stop following you. Like, yeah. You still get that perk.
Oh, I like that.
So, like, for one of the characters who I have following around with me right now, once he becomes, like, high level affinity with me, I get a 20% added bonus onto any damage I make.
Oh, that's cool.
Like, there's another one where, so there's chems. Chems, which are addicting drugs in the game that you can use.
Okay.
One of the perks from another companion is that the effects, like the perk of using the chem, lasts longer.
Oh, sure.
Because he's with you.
Sure.
Or like he's your friend.
Sure.
There's like a whole bunch of other ones that like I don't know all of them yet, but I'm trying to get a character's affinity high, and I can only do so at this point by doing main quest stuff.
Sure.
And so I'm deciding to not do that, and I'm just waiting for the radio to tell me that there's something wrong on one of my settlements so I can take him there, fix it, and he'll love that instead. Sure. And so it's taking forever and I hate it, but anyways, I'm also playing Ooblets.
Oh, okay.
It's a cozy farming game.
Yes.
With little aliens on it. I love it.
Aliens? Alien garden?
No, I'll have to show you the pictures when we're done. But anyways, Tony, what are you reading?
What am I reading? Okay, so I just, thank goodness, finally, after, I want to say 3 years. I think it's been 3 years. Maybe
I'd
two
love
and a half. Anyway, I just finished the 5th season by N.K. Jemisin.
Oh, yeah, because you wanted to read this for, like, ever, and then you keep stopping.
Yeah, I've been reading it on and off for, like, 3 years, because every time I would read a chunk, and when I say a chunk, I mean, like, 2 or 3 chapters. She's not a woman of short chapters, because she's writing epic fantasy. Of course she's not.
Of course she's not.
But I read a couple of chapters and get so viscerally upset, because it's not a... It's not a comfort read. There's no
comfort. It does not comfort you whatsoever.
There's no comfort in it at all. Well, okay. There's a tiny bit of comfort. But, of course, the problem with that book is that by the time you feel that tiny bit of comfort, you know you shouldn't be feeling it, because you're like, no. And because
why are you giving me this false sense of security,
N.K. Jemisin? Because she's N.K.
Jemisin,
she warns you in that section. She warns you. Literally, the narrator says, oh, and by the way, you did have joy at one point. I'm just not going to tell you what it felt like. And then the next chapter opens up with, I think it's something like... the last day that such and such character ever felt any kind of joy.
Oh, was... so it's like Final Fantasy, where you get the, you think everything's great, and then all of a sudden your
well,
favorite
no,
character
you don't at all.
That she gets,
I mean,
stabbed through the chest.
Not in this book. You all, you know everything. You're surprised at this point in the book that not everyone has died, because
yeah, no, that's what I mean.
At this point they should have. But this one character has been able to eke out like a kind of little tiny bit of something, but you're like, the consequences are coming, right? The consequences are coming. So the chapter opens with such and such a character lived their last day in this space as their best, you know, it was the prettiest day in the world or something like that when the world ended for them that day. And you're like, okay.
Oh, here we
and
go.
Then you get this incredible scene. I mean, just this beautiful scene where it's basically, you know, a family picnic, but like family picnics in this book don't happen.
Equal bad time.
So you're like, I fell for it. Like, I'm like, oh, yeah, yeah, okay, fine, whatever. And I'm literally like 3 hours from finishing the audiobook when this happens going, no. Oh, no, 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 because... You know what's gonna happen. Like, you know everyone.
You know we're getting red wedding.
Yeah, you know,
like,
everyone here is gonna die. But because the subsequent thing was, this is what the day was like. The day is so nice that you're
so
like.
So it gives like Arya Stark is eventually about to reunite with her family, and then all of a sudden, oh, here comes this wedding. Just kidding.
Kind of, but much worse.
Yeah, I'm just trying
to give
like a non-spoilery version of how that feels.
It's an incredible book. It's really, really well done. It deserved the Hugo that it won, obviously. Especially that year, because not very much. Anyway, I should clarify. I think that this trilogy.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't read the other two books yet. I'm taking a pause before I enter into the next one and reading something else. I don't know what it's going to be. I'm sort of, a few things are circulating around.
It's
going
to be Tokyo Ghoul Volume 1.
That'll be in there at some point. But I will say this for the fifth season. It does things that a book published in 2015 should not be able to do, in the sense that it literally depicts what it feels like now.
Oh.
And in 2015, at the time that it was published, forget when it was written, which would have been like a year or two before that, but the fact that it was published in 2015 and showing the world from inside a perspective we'd yet had, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, I think so many of us forget what pre-COVID really felt like, what that world was like. And we certainly forget all the time what it felt like to live in a pre-Trump is actually the president and COVID era. Like, that all in one go, if that had produced this book, I'd have been like, yeah, absolutely, absolutely. But the fact that it was published and written years before any of that ever came through is like, this is weirdly prescient. Okay, so I really do think that, you know, anybody who is anybody should read that book right now, because we're all living in it.
I would imagine it's also kind of prescient in regard. Well, climate change was definitely a big thing at that time.
It's climatological, but it isn't climatological in the sense that you would think of. Like,
okay.
It's not cli-fi in the way that cli-fi has become its own...
thing.
Subgenre of science fiction. Don't get me started.
That'll be another episode.
I loathe.
That'll be another episode.
I think that's one of its strengths, is that because it isn't responding to just one specific thing, it's responding to so many things that were happening, that were in progress at that time, but because so many other things had happened, and it was the last Obama year, like, a lot of people still had a huge amount of hope in 2015 that we don't have no more. So, you know, it's I feel like it's like a right now kind of book in a way that I didn't feel when it first was published, which is why it took me so long to read it. So anyway, I read it, loved it, or loved its genius. It's hard to say I loved it, but I loved its genius, and I'm looking forward to the sequel. So yeah, that's what I was reading, am reading, could have been reading, was reading, and yeah.
Grant.
Yeah, nothing else is going on entertainment-wise for me, I don't think,
Grant.
At the moment. Grant!
Okay, well, first of all, I'm still riding the Dune high from seeing Dune Part 2.
Oh, did you see? I was going to see it so bad.
I'm waiting until next weekend.
Cool. I'll have to wait a couple weeks.
It's definitely worth it to see it in a theater.
Good, because I missed the first one in theaters.
Yeah, it's...
That was good. You should have came with us.
It was good.
I was working.
No.
I was. It's not my fault.
Anyways. Because
you were still both on the same Saturdays, so I was actually working.
It was at the end of the day, because it was nighttime.
I didn't know that.
Grant, you're riding the Dune High?
Yes, I'm riding the Dune High. It was very good. It's kind of better than the first one by default, because it maintains the same quality from the first one, except there's just more Dune. So,
yeah, and
I finally saw a picture of what Austin Butler looked like in that movie, and I'm like, oh my
it's
god.
It's probably also more movie-ish than the first one tends to be, or maybe,
not,
do you think?
No. Didn't necessarily notice that.
Okay.
It, how so? Like more cinematic?
I guess I'm just thinking, like, no, not necessarily more cinematic, but more of, like, when people think of science fiction movies, they tend to think of a lot of action.
I mean, there is more action.
And there's, just from the trailer, it's like, okay, there's definitely more action. So yeah,
it's not the focus.
Oh, good.
I would say.
Okay, good.
They definitely, from what I can see from clips / people talking about it online, they definitely lean more towards the political aspects of the...
I mean, I would hope so. I mean, they kind of set you up in the first movie to deal with
it. Yeah, no, there is political stuff in there. There's...
Because if you didn't want to deal with political stuff, you just kill Paul Atreides at the end of the movie.
Exactly.
Or his mom.
Or Paul.
Yeah, or his mom.
No. No, I'm very glad that Denis didn't brush past the... moral complexities of Paul and his journey, and how his mother plays into that.
Yeah,
there are some significant, more so at the very end of the movie. There are some significant changes from the end of the book. Nothing like coarse, you know, changing. That's just me having read the book and like the first one. I'm probably gonna have to see it a second time to like form a final opinion on it, because I still had like the book in my mind while I was sitting to watch it.
Oh yeah, you would. Yeah, and how much of it has any Dune Messiah elements in it? Because I've been hearing about that it's...
Dune Messiah elements? Not much, other than the presence of a certain character that in an adult form that you don't see until Dune Messiah in an adult form.
Is that the princess?
No. You see her. She's in the first scene, actually. She's kind of the through line. Her, similar to the first book, she her journal. It kind of goes back to her writing.
Right, okay, so you get to see some of that in the...
Yes, and then she becomes a character in her own right.
Oh, nice, okay.
Yeah, and last thing I'll say about it, every scene on the I think it's Gaiti Prime, the Harkonnen homeworld, it's really, really cool. I think it's because of whatever type of sun their planet has. It's whenever they're outside, it's in black and white. It's just so awesome. It's really cool.
It's whatever filters they were using in that
thing. It's
that's fun.
I don't even have to say it, but it's a visually stunning movie, so I'd... If you can see it in theaters, go see it in theaters.
That's good, yeah. I mean, you know, that's the knee. That's just what he does, you know.
Am I reading anything? Yeah. Yes. Mm. I'm currently, in addition to the stuff I'm always
reading.
Besides the stuff that you're slogging through.
I started Erotism, Death and Sensuality. I don't know how to pronounce it. That's the title of the book. I'm sorry.
Interesting.
George Bataille.
Okay.
Which, you know, he's a, he's a writer and intellectual from... He's a Frenchman from the 1900s, 1920s. I think he lived into the 1960s. He was writing up until he died.
Oh, wow. That's remarkable.
And I think his writings are so broad and all over the place that I think that's might be why he's not more well known. Sure. But anyways, this one, it has to do with a lot of... I mean, he deals with like excess and taboos and stuff a lot in his work.
Mm-hmm.
And so far, this one's dealing a lot with taboo and the breaking of those taboos and how he kind of separates it into the realm of the... What are the terms that he uses? The
A term.
I'm sorry. Yeah.
No, no, it's okay.
It's okay.
Yeah. The
it's Tuesday.
The profane and the sacred, which mean mean different things to him than, and how taboos and the breaking of taboos, they reinforce each other, and he gets into like the excess that comes naturally with civilization and how he views it almost like a pressure release type thing.
Sure.
I don't know. I'll talk about it more when I finish.
Sure. No, it sounds really interesting.
Yeah. No, it is. And he wrote a lot of fiction as well. He wrote The Story of the Eye, which is probably his most famous book, which I haven't read.
Interesting.
But, yeah.
Huh.
That's what I'm reading.
Yeah.
People... Well, speaking of things that, Grant's reading.
Yeah.
He's picking out for us. So we're starting on a new entire series that's going to take us out into summer reading this year.
Ooh,
so for, to start this off, let me explain what we're doing. Every single episode is going to be one of us has picked a book, and we are going to read it, or at least read as much as we can of it, and discuss what we know / what we've read and why people have picked the certain books. And so for this episode, we have started off with our own little mini book club by Grant's pick.
Hooray!
And what did Grant pick?
I picked Naked Lunch by William S. Burroughs.
Yes!
Yes. How do we want to start this?
Why did you want us to read it?
That was the question I was going to ask too, and I'm glad you asked it first because I wanted to be asked before anything else.
it seems to be. Yeah, I love the number 3, so I'll give you 3 reasons. I'll have to come up with a third one.
Well,
So I'd say A, it's one of my favorite works of literature that I've read.
Okay.
B, William Burroughs is one of my favorite authors, creators, artists in general.
Mm-hmm.
I'll give you a few more reasons. I feel like, I don't know. I feel like it was a very formative text for me.
When did you first read it?
I want to say high school.
Really?
At some point.
Interesting.
Like, I feel like he's a fellow traveler of mine in a way.
Sure.
And so when I found out about his writing in general, I just ate it up.
Of course.
And I was just really interested to see how guys would react to it.
All right. So here's how I feel.
Oh, Tony's going to
No, it's not bad.
Throw us out there.
Well, it's not entirely bad. Okay, so. I don't do time crunches well.
Neither do I.
True,
but that's okay.
And I realize that you didn't have a lot of time.
No, this is no fault on you or the book. That's why I'm starting with this. I don't do time crunch as well.
Mm-hmm.
So any book would have been challenging at this point of any book of any length, unless it was like Winnie the Pooh. but anything with any complexity, I'll put it that way. Anything with any kind of any level of complexity would have been challenging. Knowing the level of complexity.
It is a. I thought I would have.
Yeah. Again, no fault of the choice. I think I should have attempted to read this over the weekend so that I could take breaks and take more time. Dissecting things or that kind of thing. I read the first story last night. I really liked the narrator of that one.
Mm-hmm.
So then I flipped to the last story, right? Because they're connected, right? Or they're
kinda.
Loosely, they're
yeah.
whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it's like a crime story, kind of.
Yeah. I picked up on that.
Okay.
I picked up.
Detective fiction has a... He was inspired by detective fiction to varying degrees.
I could see that because he does have a very... Raymond Chandler.
Yeah, and he was a contemporary of Chandler.
And everybody who writes any kind of inkling of crime fiction in the United States and even outside of the United States from the time that Chandler was publishing his work until maybe a couple of decades ago, they were all influenced by Chandler. I mean, and if they said that they weren't, they were lying. So anyway, all that is to say, I read those 2 pages.
Okay.
And then I read that page and like half of that one, and okay. I stopped.
So you started on Wouldn't You? Is that what you're saying?
No, I started on.
Oh, you started on the opening, the very opening one. Section, then you okay.
Yeah and Start West. Okay. I started on and Start okay. West. I was tempted to then just read The Vigilante before flipping all the way back up to the Atrophy. Whatever. Pretty cool. I kind of wish I had, just so I could have gotten a little bit more. Mm-hmm. But oh my god. Atrophied preface.
No, it starts kind of comprehensible and then it descends.
It into broke me. Madness, yeah. It did. But you know what's so interesting about that? From what I can sense.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder how much of this, and I haven't read any of his interviews or anything, I'm sure I could mm-hmm. find the answer if I looked, but I didn't want to look because I wanted this to be a part of the conversation. I really was interested in how much effort a writer has to go through to write something this natural.
No, ooh, that's this.
No,
you go first. I was going to say that, well, I like how you said natural because it really. It betrays the amount of work that you put into it, because it feels very stream of consciousness and flow. I mean,
yeah,
he wrote. Does. I believe Naked Lunch was written over the period of like 7 years.
Because he put it in like.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
No. And
how?
What? Okay. Yeah. Aaron.
He put it in like different like what is it like newspapers or something or like a little book thing.
Yeah, he had. So he called it his word hoard.
Okay.
He, sure.
He was
and,
a dragon.
And his first few
he hoarded words.
Yeah, his first few collected works, Naked Lunch included, came from this word hoard.
Oh, that's interesting.
Which he wrote in multiple countries.
Sure.
For you know, he was on the run for various reasons.
Sure.
So we had this word hoard, and that's why you see a lot of recurring characters. Sentences, turns of phrase as well, which was very purposeful because, and he develops that further in his cut up trilogy.
Yes,
which he does a little bit in Naked Lunch, where he introduces the element of chance into the actual structure of the book, where he develops that a lot more intensely in the cut up trilogy, which comes after this and is even harder to read.
He uses a lot of the cut up method for that.
Yes, which I could do a whole episode on the cut up books because they're very interesting. How you almost feel like you're getting a flashback to the future and stuff. He messes with time a lot.
Sure.
Not as much in this, but I didn't want to start you guys out.
How much of his influences, whether he knew them or not, were science fiction fix-up novels.
Fix-up?
Mm-hmm. Because the idea of the science fiction fix-up novel is really old. I think even Lovecraft wrote a fix-up mm-hmm. novel. But they're basically where you take a whole bunch of stories that seem like they may or may not be connected. Bradbury did a couple of them. The Martian Chronicles is a fix-up novel where you just, you know,
where they seem like they don't connect to each other, but if you
put them together in a thing, especially if you put them in the right order or if you fudge them a little bit, something connects these more than just the consciousness of the writer, if that makes sense. And there have been writers since Burroughs's time that have done fix-up novels intentionally, but it used to be a thing all the time that, you know, a story editor of a magazine would go, hey, want to be an author of a novel? Want to actually have a book making money? Take these 10 stories that we published here and the 5 you published last year in this other publication, put them together and call it a novel and
that's it.
Bradbury, again, won Hugos for this. I mean, it was a thing. So I'm curious, like, how much of his own reading life maybe was in part influenced by that?
I mean, I know for a fact he was a very, very broad reader. Mm. He didn't really... I mean, he was very... He's a very interesting figure because on one mm-hmm. hand, he was very highly educated. He was born into money. And on the other hand, he eked a living in the underground, I guess.
Yeah.
And he, like we didn't mention it, but...
He likes this book. Karen.
Yes, much of this was... yeah, no, obviously he had a... He had a deep heroin addiction for many years, and that's...
Oh, that. Interesting.
Yes.
You see a lot of highs and lows when... So I'm like 60 pages in. Like, because I'm just reading straight through.
Did you finish the Benway chapter, by the way?
Benway
chapter? When everybody get... Oh, I don't want
to
spoil
it. Well, yeah. Yeah, she would have had to have.
Okay.
Wait, which one's the Benway chapter?
I think it's literally just called
Benway. Oh, Benway?
Yeah.
Is that the one with the doctor?
With the doctor. And
they're doing the surgery in the room.
Also, you can totally spoil this book for me. Because the thing I wanted to actually, like, say, too, in addition to other things that I said, is that... The part of the reason that I feel like I want to read this outside of a time crunch is I'm very, very interested, because I loved Anne Starwest. I mean, I didn't know what the heck I was reading, but I was interested. I'm like, oh, this is interesting. I'm just very, very interested in this as a writer. I want to get inside of the writer's brain and think like him for the strength for the length of the book, just to see, like, why would you produce this? Not just like, oh, because it's so, it's not just that it's unconventional, it's that it is, I don't know what it is. Do you know what I mean? Like, I don't know what to call it.
Exactly. You know? I mean, even today, he's a very disputed and controversial author. I mean, like, I've heard people call him the first postmodern writer. I've heard people call him the last modernist writer. I've heard people call him trash. I've heard people call him a genius.
Ooh, the first postmodern. That's interesting.
Well, I mean, considering he's the one who really popularized cut up in actual writing.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean,
like, that cut up method was started, if I remember right, which actually makes sense when you say he grew up in money, because it started, cut up method began being a big thing in the Dada movement, which was in the 20s, which he would have, like, been growing up a little bit after that, but, like, if he's running around in, like, money circles, he would have already been running around in those things, so it makes sense. And somebody on Reddit, and I looked it up, and I guess it's true, but apparently, like, with his cut-up method, he also used to make paintings.
Yeah, no,
like, he would, like, shoot paintings to decide his method.
He's a visual artist. He called it shotgun painting.
I did finish Benway, and the reason that I remember I finished Benway is because I literally highlighted the phrase, but brain cells don't come back once they're gone when the addict runs out of brain cells. He's in a terrible position. Mm-hmm. And I went, ooh, ouch.
Okay, I'm gonna try to come back to
but
what I was.
I also finished Hospital.
At the moment I can't remember.
That's the one where they're doing a whole entire, like, surgery in a bathroom.
Oh, okay.
With Ben, because Benway's in that one too.
No, Benway's one of his greatest,
like,
funniest characters.
I'm like, oh my god.
Yeah, I should have mentioned that. His writing is very humorous. He called his stories, like, he would refer to them as routines. They're very satirical, very humorous.
Well, he's funny. I mean, just
read Benway, and then you get to Hospital, and then you just start cackling just a little bit because you're reading all the because it's done in, like, script format in Hospital.
And
you get to Hospital, and it's just somebody on the other side of a door because they're going to go into the lavatory, but the lavatory's locked, and you hear Benway, there's another doctor, and then there's a nurse, and then there's some lady on the floor, and they're performing surgery on the lady on the floor.
Oh.
And the commentary Benway just has is just like, you are a doctor who has been tenured in your position for far too long, and you really just don't care anymore. He's like that tenured professor position where he's just like,
sure.
And it's just there, and it's funny, but also horrifying, because I watched a lot of paranormal investigations right before I read this book, and so my brain is like, are they in Pennhurst? Is this, like, a horrible thing going on? Because, like, a few years after he finishes writing all of these is when, you know, they start closing down a lot of the state asylums because of horrible things like that are in the Hospital episode, and I'm like, okay.
I'm not sure, but I would honestly be surprised if he wasn't in some sort of facility for a while.
Sure.
I think that's almost... Some of these like, you're going through a facility, and especially, and I don't remember which one it was, it might have been the Rube, where, like, basically he's, like, whatever character you're following is, like, going down a hallway, and they're basically, like, giving a tour of this facility, and if you look to your left, you have this type of addict, but if you look to the right, you have this type of addict, and then they reach another hallway, and they go, oh, this thing's here, we need to get rid of that because it ruins the tourism, and I'm like, Oh, no. This is like you're going through like one of those state asylum hospitals that have been closed down now because they were so horrifying. Mm-hmm. And it's like he's like going down being told like, this is this wing and this is this wing. And it's like you have a reporter behind you and you're like, we can't show him this wing because this is where we keep all of the bad stuff and we don't want anyone to see it. So it's kind of like a, maybe like a detoxy, like low thing going on and...
Yeah, because he obviously had experience with that. And if I can really quick go back to what you were saying, Tony, about his influences. Yeah, so he has very, very broad influences. He pulls equally from detective novels, science fiction, whatever you would want to call it, classic literature or whatever. And, modernism. Modernism. His childhood and bringing up. And that's what leads to, nobody else writes exactly like him. And I think part of it is the very peculiar mixture of influences and language, like language from science fiction and, these very super obscure technical references. And I feel like that's part of what makes him so unique.
I'm curious. I'm going to comment on something and then I'm going to ask something too.
Yeah.
So... the comment is, because I just was looking and I was like, yes, I knew it. I knew he was a Beat Generation writer within a page and a half. And the reason why is not because I remembered it, but because I remembered something else. I remember I read 200 pages of Jack Kerouac's, may have only been 150, but I read like in one sitting of Jack Kerouac's On the Road before I realized that I'd read that many pages and I had no clue what was happening. Not a single red cent. Mm-hmm. A page and a half into this, and I was like, this feels familiar. Oh my God, is he a Beat Generation writer? I don't know, because Kerouac's less genius than this. I know that. But there's a similar feeling to the way their prose hits the page.
They actually worked on a novel together. I can't remember the name.
They did, that's right. Can't remember which one it is.
Yeah, I haven't read it, but
that's right. They did. Yeah.
And I know him even into like old age for both of them. He was very good friends with Allen Ginsberg.
Yeah, and the three of them were.
Yeah, and the three of them. I think I'm pretty sure Ginsberg and Kerouac helped him put together Naked Lunch, like collect it out of his word hoard.
Oh, that's cool.
And he would like send them pages.
Sure.
Because he was like hiding out in Manila or wherever, you know.
Yeah. How much of the rest of the Beat Generation have you been able to read, or have you
I've read quite read? A bit of like I've read quite a bit of Ginsberg's poetry. I've read Howl. I've read some of his other stuff, and I haven't read as much of Kerouac. I haven't read On the Road, but I've always been very intrigued by him. It seems more travel-y than I would be into.
On the Road is more conventional.
Conventional.
Certainly.
Like, so that's what I've read. And I'm not very familiar outside of the main three.
Sure, I don't think anyone really is unless they went to college for it.
And I know Burroughs' wife, Joan, I can't remember her last name, who died under mysterious circumstances.
Your mysterious circumstances!
Of course she did. I know she was in that scene as well.
Oh, wow. Okay,
she was she was kind of well-known in her own right.
Yeah, that's really cool.
Yeah.
So then my question was...
Yes.
It's harder to sort of pin this down. No, maybe not. Can you name any writers that you have read that you see or have just outright stated that they were influenced by Burroughs?
Blake Butler, for sure.
Okay.
He's one of my favorites going right now. Definitely, I would be very, very... J.G. Ballard, 100% was... He's written some introductions for some of Burroughs' work as well.
Sure.
I know he was kind of a contemporary. I'd be very surprised if who wrote Dahlgren. I know you like him.
Samuel R. Delaney.
If he wasn't aware, at the very least, of what he was doing.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly think that Burroughs must have impressed Delaney, who's hard to impress because he's Delaney. Because they were, I think, if they weren't the same age, they were certainly close in age. I would imagine. I don't know who would have been older. Mm-hmm. Burroughs might have been older, but yeah.
And I know Burroughs was a huge influence on like the punk scene. Like,
oh, sure.
Like, even, like, which is kind of weird because you think of it mainly as a music movement, but just as like a, you know, his books are so paranoid and anti-establishment.
Yeah.
I mean, he can read all of them.
He really, like, his big theme is control mm-hmm. and the different forms that control takes, mm-hmm. whether it be through drugs or policing or anything like that.
Sure.
Yeah. So I can see why the punk move, why the young punk movement would gravitate towards him. And
yeah.
The writers that emerge from that would definitely be mm-hmm. Inspired by him.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because I'm interested, too, in just, like, how... You know, I love, like, literary lineages because mm-hmm. I'm strange that way. But I'm interested in how many of the, like, transgressive writers
were obviously
Dennis,
impacted
like
by...
Dennis Cooper?
I can only imagine that he was exposed to Burroughs early on.
Yeah, certainly. And I certainly think that...
Really any post... 60s author that experiments with form in is a gay writer.
Or both.
deals with themes as dark as Burroughs does.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Often without the humor of Burroughs, unfortunately.
Yeah.
I feel is to some extent inspired.
Yeah. So David Foster Wallace probably owes William S. Burroughs a big check for Infinite Jest. I could say that too.
I've always meant to get into him because he's written very interesting essays on like David Lynch and stuff. People that I love. Yeah. I just haven't hated myself enough to sit down and read one of his books.
I have honestly. So I have not. But I bought Infinite Jest and one of his short story collections. Solely on a like 25-page Zadie Smith essay mm-hmm. in which not only does she, because she's Zadie Smith and she's insane, mm-hmm. not only does she like say, hey, I read a bunch of David Foster Wallace books at a pivotal time and this is what I think, she tries to use his way of writing essays to then write an essay about his body of work.
Really?
Oh my goodness. It is, I had never read any of his stuff except like a, you know, an essay here or there. Mm-hmm. I'd never read any of his fiction, and the way that she just like unpacks how she felt while reading his work and how so much of it was impossible to understand on a first read mm-hmm. that she would be spending the rest of her lifetime just having conversations on the page with David Foster Wallace. I highly recommend, I'm going to look up the name of that essay and get it to you because I highly recommend reading that if you're looking to get into David Foster Wallace because, one, she'll give you pointers, but also she'll say things about him that no one else has ever said, which is what makes that essay so fascinating because everyone thinks that they know, including people who were friends with him and worked with him. I think Jonathan Franz is the only one who's like, none of us know what he was really doing. He didn't know what he was really doing, and he's telling the truth. Whereas Zadie Smith, like, goes in with the eye of an avid reader who also is a scholar mm-hmm. and a university professor and is able to just sort of unpack all of that stuff. I really think that you would enjoy David Foster Wallace just based on the essay of itself, in and of itself. In fact, I have gifts for you.
Oh?
Yeah. But it'll be on Thursday. Anyway, all of that is to say, I really have a feeling that, like, obviously, like, all of the postmodernists, mm-hmm. that's why when you said earlier, like, something about him being either the first postmodernist or the last modernist, mm-hmm. I mean, certainly there's nothing about him that's modernist. I don't know who was foolish enough to say that the last modernist was Virginia Woolf, and no, let's not go there. I have thoughts.
No, I can see the postmodernist bit.
I know she's not the last modernist, but she certainly is, you know, the one who should have been the last modernist. You know, but
my Faulkner loving heart is crying right now.
They were contemporaries.
Okay.
True.
He lived much longer.
Lived longer because she was older, but yeah, you know, yeah. Okay, so Faulkner should have been the last modernist.
Also, I'm bleeding.
There we go.
So I'll deal with that later.
Sure, you heard it here, folks. I'm really interested in seeing like what Naked Lunch is.
What about?
Because it's so it feels like it's so much bigger than my mind has the possibility of like absorbing. Like, so how many times have you read Naked Lunch?
All the way, probably 3.
That's interesting.
Not always. Like the second time I read it out of order.
Oh right. Yes.
I think I mentioned that on the podcast.
Yeah.
And I will say that you know, Naked Lunch, while very good and it's his most well known work,
it's not the end all be all of Burroughs. If you would prefer, like, my favorite book of his personally is his final novel, The Western Lands.
I have heard more than one person say that, actually.
Which deals a lot with, you know, deals with, like, themes of mortality and...
Isn't it a fantasy, too?
It deals with Egyptian mythology, and he uses that as, like, a character walking through the afterlife. And he takes the disjointed style of his early work, but it's more chiseled into... It's more...
Sure.
You know what I'm... It's more refined, obviously, because he's an older man and polished and whatnot. And, you know, I'd say that's probably his best work overall.
Yeah.
But... You know, just look. You can easily look into his bibliography, and if you see something that catches your eye, you know, because it's in varying levels of experimentalism and stuff. So,
yeah, and I think that's the other thing too that makes him so interesting is that, you know, even if you don't, that's hilarious. The novel he wrote with Kerouac is called "And the Hippos Were Boiled in Their Tanks," and that just makes me want to read it. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, I think that's the fascinating thing about his catalog is that there's so many things.
And if you want nonfiction, well, mostly nonfiction, more memoir-ish, his first two books, Queer and Junkie, they kind of...
Oh, it's cool.
Similar in tone, minus some of the humor, to Naked Lunch.
Sure.
It deals a lot with addiction and stuff.
I'm also just really fascinated by Burroughs, too, because, you know, I feel strongly that... It's unfortunate that Kerouac wears the face of the Beat Generation, but without that, I think all of those writers, with the exception of Ginsberg, would have been lost somehow. Because, you know, the poets aren't going to let you forget one of the heroes, and Ginsberg is too much of a hero for too many poets for them to be like him, for him to go anywhere. Mm-hmm. But novelists and people who read novelists are really picky and dysfunctional as a group, which is why we fight so much. But because Burroughs is so different than any other writer of the decades he was writing, I mean, you know, other people became Burroughs-like, but, I mean, even Delaney didn't start out as Burroughs-like because he didn't grow up reading Burroughs. He grew up reading, you know, Heinlein, you know, and Asimov. But, like, that's what's so interesting is to see how... He spawned whole generations of writers, like the transgressive writers and the, you know, the queer transgressive writers. Like, I don't think there are whole groups of writers, I think, that wouldn't necessarily be what they are. Like, could you imagine if Dennis Cooper had never read William S. Burroughs or had, like, read him beyond his formative years?
Mm-hmm.
What would he have written about? Like, do you know what I mean? Or, like, or like even more importantly, like, how would he have written about it? You know what I mean? Mm-hmm.
I feel like just every once in a while with just an artist or something, there are, even if they're not exactly the creator of certain trends or whatever, they all reach they all reach a point with a single person, and they become a wellspring of inspiration.
Yeah, I mean, in a completely opposite even just style or method or approach to writing, Tolkien is this for fantasy. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, he's the point through which everyone sees this, despite how long of a tale, you know, fantasy has had on the planet.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
He really was not only just in his essays saying, hey, guess what? Pay attention to this stuff because it's great. But he also wrote one of the best examples, even to this day. Yeah, I know all you people who like to hate on Lord of the Rings and you prefer the Potter. Throw him out.
Are there actually people who...
There are people who say that for them, fantasy didn't really begin or didn't get good until Harry Potter, and I have a lot of foul things to say about that statement that I will not say here. But...
Somebody who started their fantasy.
But you were a kid.
I was a child.
You were a kid. That's so a completely different thing.
That's a different concept, everyone.
I still
acknowledge that Lord of the Rings is better.
I also feel that people who read Lord of the Rings as kids have a, you know, they have their own, like oh my God, like oversized, like Lord of the Rings is everything kind of thing firing there.
Mm-hmm.
I'm coming from the perspective of neither of those camps because I was too old to start. Actually, I was right. I was Harry Potter generation, but I was a reader already. Anyway, that's not the point. The point is, I love that there are those kind of like tentpole writers. It's just interesting how sometimes they become a Tolkien and other times they become a Burroughs. You know what I mean? Like there's like
more with,
Oh, sorry.
No, like, I feel like, I just feel like without the group of writers that have grown up in Burroughs' wake, who all must have read him at some point because they're all writing Burroughs-like stuff, I feel like he would have been lost. Do you know what I mean? If all those people would not have had the courage to do postmodernism. Because, you know, postmodernism was a movement, but none of them knew they were in a movement until afterwards. And then the critics were going, thank God it's all over. And Daniel Foster Wallace is like, wait, what?
When, it's really interesting.
When was it over?
Hold my beer.
Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly.
I've never thought about, like, actual books, like, in postmodernist. Granted, but that's because I come from the art history side of things. So, like, I think of postmodernist as, like, the paintings on the wall or, like, postmodernism as, like, you know, the feminist, like, photographic movement that, like, happened later on.
Yeah.
Like, your performance, your Fluxus movements, which are, like, a whole, like, hodgepodge of, like, crazy performance art.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, that's how I think of postmodernist. Mm-hmm. Like, I still don't think of, like, books also within those movements
mm-hmm.
because of the fact that, like, I had to be very clearly in a different headspace for those. And so, like, thinking, like, oh, this is postmodernist, like, it makes sense as to why a lot of it doesn't make sense because of, like, knowing, like, it's postmodernist. I'm like, yeah, I can see the connection and that maybe, like, some of the postmodern artists were probably running in the same circles as Burroughs, like, during that time frame.
Yeah, it happened with surrealism more...
Surrealism.
More in French literature than American, because in America we're famously slow to everything.
The Berlin School of Art.
But yeah, I mean, surrealism changed the face of French literature forever.
No, people don't realize how influential surrealism was on theory, on arts, day-to-day life. Yeah, no, it's crazy.
No, surrealism was nuts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was. So yeah, I mean, I think it's fascinating that Burroughs brings out all of this in people who even haven't read as much as you have. So do you read, when you go back to read Naked Lunch, do you pick out, like, what your favorite story is or something that you're thinking of at the time? Or, because you said you only have,
roll,
like,
the
finished
dice
it three
which,
times.
Which one
yeah.
So I'm curious,
mean, and,
do you
and,
just kind of dive
and,
in at
and,
different
and,
points?
And
or?
Yeah, I mean, I've read it through a few times, like, from beginning to end, and then
sure.
I've read it out of order, and I've just gone to, like, a certain short story or something.
Yeah, and then just read it that way, yeah.
One that you guys didn't get to, and one that we definitely can't talk about on the podcast, is Asan's Rumpus Room.
Oh, come on!
Which,
I know.
Is this the reason
now
the
I want to read
it. Yeah,
I would imagine it was one of the chapters cited as.
Oh, it did get banned. Oh, I
yeah,
love
this
it.
Was a banned book by
I
the
love
way.
A good
everyone.
Banned book. Well,
no, I mean it's a very.
It's by a queer postmodernist.
Of course, no, and he pulls equally from pornography as he does from, vaudeville. So,
which is where I mean, you know, Delaney's whole. Post, like, when he literally just goes,
oh,
I'm going to write post
that's the next chapter I'm reading.
Because
mm-hmm. oh,
Delaney has this weird, this is one of the reasons that I kind of am interested in Burroughs as well, is that Delaney has this whole, Samuel R. Delaney, for those of us who don't know who I'm talking about, he starts his career off right by writing these very formal sci-fi novels that are basically just space operas. But they're not even formal space operas because they do weird things like send a poet into space. And that's the whole book. Like, it's not the whole book, but, like, that's the it centers on this poet going into space and, you know, sending back what she sees.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, like, who writes that as a space opera, right? But it's
a
cool idea.
Okay,
it's a cool idea, right?
Now realize why we can't
Delaney, like, starts off writing these sort of formula-ready sci-fi novels because he'd read plenty of them. And then he does something weird. People always cite Dahlgren because Dahlgren is, like, the primary example of this. But then he starts writing what can only be called Burroughs-esque science fiction, where he basically is still the brilliant Samuel R. Delaney, but then he just starts throwing all of this other stuff in there to, you know, that, you know, no one else was doing at the time.
Yeah.
I mean, not really. So he has a period of that, right? Mm-hmm. And then he just goes from there. He writes the one memoir that gets him a lot of attention. And then he starts writing porn. Literally, and that's what he's calling it. Like, he's like,
are we even allowed to talk about that on the podcast?
I think we can.
No, I mean, I can say the word.
My hot take of the day, I think pornography is one of the great untapped artistic...
Yes. No, yeah. I think what's interesting about it from a writer's perspective is that a writer sat down and said, I think that this is important enough to not only just write a sex scene, right? Because we're all adults, right? We've all read books with sex scenes in them. We all have
our
thoughts.
That's what I'm literally reading right now.
Yeah. We have our thoughts, feelings, opinions, whatever, about where they belong, why they should belong, all that kind of thing. But it's a different, completely different kind of experience to say, as a writer of anything, I'm going to make this the central tenet of my work, whatever the work is, and I'm going to call it that. Like, I'm not going to pretend. I'm not going to fake it. I'm going to say, this is what the goal of this is.
Alan Moore said a very similar thing when, I haven't read it, but I can't remember. It was a graphic novel. But anyways, he said, this is pornography. Like, I'm putting this out. And he preemptively said that because people are going to be calling it that anyways, you know, and there's going to be a whole fervor.
Yeah. But Christopher Rice said that the most embarrassing moment of his life was when his friends called because they had discovered his mom's porn. And they were like, we just thought she wrote about vampires. And he's like, joke's on you. How was it? And they were like, well, it's kind of weird. He was like,
A horror novel scares, a drama novel takes you into this story.
I'm almost terrified to edit this episode after my brain just immediately like...
We've said worse stuff, come on.
Are you sure?
I don't know.
We said Murder Snatch.
We did say Murder Snatch multiple times.
I don't even...
One was the Downton Abbey episode because there's a murder snatch in that show.
Which she should still
this is just a pretty PG-13 the other
episode was the Bridgerton episode.
This is just, you know, PG-13 episode.
Yeah. I'm just saying.
Burroughs opened a lot of doors for the extreme, for how extreme certain things.
Yeah, sure. I find that in and of itself to be a reason to return to this writer no matter who you are as a reader. I mean, I think that obviously this is much more of a your bookshelf than it is mine. But that's what I find so fascinating about it, is that it's rare to find a book that reshapes the way you think about books. Mm-hmm. You know, that isn't, that was just a really good time. Like, no. Then you gotta be... And even books like, I mean, The Fifth Season plays with formula, but it does so in a completely different way with a completely different aim than this book. I don't know that you can say that. I mean, I don't know. Maybe if I read enough essays or critical material or whatever from Burroughs, he might have said, yes, I had a point. I don't know that that could be borne out by a man who can write like this, which is why I put the question to you earlier of like, how does a writer even become so free to do something like this? Because that...
I feel... it's something that others have said, and I feel like I value in writers, like, a level of honesty with themselves that allows you to project in such an honest way, honest in an idiosyncratic way.
Do you feel that that's something that, speaking of a writer that was... I think he's even said that William S. Burroughs was a core foundational, you know... person, a figure. Do you think that Bret Easton Ellis has lost and then regained that? Or maybe is he working on regaining that sense? Or do you think he ever had it? I don't know.
A sense of what? Sorry.
That sense we were talking about of Burroughs, of just the freedom to allow yourself to just be you, unvarnished on the page, no matter how dark or scary or that face that Aaron is making.
I would say as far as the topics that he's the topics that he's willing to include, he's always been very brave in that regard. I'm talking about Ellis. But stylistically, I would connect him more with like a Kerouac. Even it's very very first person driven. I don't know. That's not the right way to put, because Burroughs is...
No, but I know what you mean.
You know what
it's
I mean.
It's more
it's
conventional.
Just more conventional, yes. He works in a more conventional setting, yeah.
Sure, yeah. No, that makes sense. Yeah. With Burroughs, I couldn't tell you where this... This is an invented country, as far as I know of. And it could be. He could literally walk in and be like, no, I was describing New York City. I'd be like, of course you were.
Yeah, and I think some of the more exotic locales are inspired by some of the other countries he was in, you know.
Yeah, which, so, again, makes sense if you're pulling from your own experience, if you're pulling from science fiction, then you would know a way to write about a place that you are familiar with that no one else is. Yeah. So, I don't know. Anyway, this is great.
All I have to say is... I'm going to cleanse my palate by reading Tokyo Ghoul Volume 1 for the next episode, because I just finished the chapter that you just talked about. I can't. Oh my god.